The Guardian.
I'm Heather Stewart. This is Politics Weekly.
A choice between the strong and stable leadership of the Conservatives.
Strong and stable Conservative leadership.
Tory MPs are learning their election lines, but is it time to count the spoons?
Will the Prime Minister give a clear and unambiguous commitment to maintaining the triple lock on the state pension?
We have seen pensioners benefit as a result of what we've done to the basic state pension.
With Brexit set to dominate the election, are we any closer to knowing Labour's EU strategy? And will the Lib Dems hoover up ardent Remain voters? Meanwhile, the UK Independence Party relaunches with a roster of anti-Islam policies as its leader refuses to even say he's standing. Has Brexit killed UKIP? Now, as Parliament heads into recess and the civil service into election purdah, all the main national parties head into this election with a leader untested at a general election. Jeremy Corbyn was caught without an answer on nuclear weapons. Theresa May was caught without an answer on scrapping the pension's triple lock. And Tim Farron was forced into giving his views on gay sex. Meanwhile, the parties are scrabbling to get new candidates vetted and nominated, manifestos written, buses booked, and leaflets with the right election date printed. Not always successfully. So to talk about all of that, I'm joined by James McGrory, Director of Open Britain and former advisor to Nick Clegg, Rowena Mason, The Guardian's Deputy Political Editor, and our columnist John Harris. James McGrory, you did all this only 2 years ago for the Lib Dems. Give us a sense of what the leaders' offices are like in the early days of an election.
It's genuinely quite exciting. I mean, if you're in politics, you should be in politics to fight elections. So it's probably the best time to be in politics. And if you've got the wind in your sails, which the Lib Dems quite rightly feel they have at the moment, it's even better. Obviously, it's a more benign circumstances now than they were in 2015.
you were also involved, closely involved in the Remain campaign, weren't you? So we're not always on the winning side.
Just a long track record of success.
Exactly. Rowena, it's clear that the Lib Dems are going all out to target the Remain voters in both Tory and Labour seats. But what can we tell from how the other campaigns are shaping up, do you think, how they're going to play this?
Well, I think the Conservatives are going to try and keep their pledges really vague, focus completely on the competition between Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn as candidates to be Prime Minister. And Theresa May is just going to repeat over and over and over again until we're all sick of it that she wants to run a strong and stable government.
I think we're already sick of it, yeah.
Well, we in politics are, but these things can take a little bit longer to filter through to the electorate.
Absolutely. And what about Labour wants to talk more about policy, don't they?
Yes, Labour have got some policies that they've polled and think are really popular with the public, things like free school meals for all primary school children and a pay rise for NHS workers. If they can try and break through into the public consciousness with those policies, that's their absolutely ideal situation. And then UKIP are looking pretty rocky. I mean, they're standing candidates in very few seats, and the Conservatives have basically eaten their lunch on Brexit. So that means that really the only political space left for them has been to go even further to the right with these sort of anti-Islam policies, some of them pretty unpleasant, and they're polling extremely badly. It looks like most of their voters are switching over to the Tories for now. So they're looking pretty dead in this election, but with the caveat that they could come back in future if voters feel like Theresa May has betrayed them over Brexit.
Yes, it's a terrible moment for them, isn't it? Because at the moment she's saying Brexit, we're going to do it, but we don't know what deal they're going to have. John, you're down in the West Country today, and you'll be off around Britain, no doubt, on your Guardian documentary series Anywhere But Westminster. Is it fair to say Britain's not yet caught election fever?
No, I've started out on the road already. So
excellent.
We began in Cornwall in Redruth, which is on the far southwestern tip of England, on Monday morning. And I mean, as usual, really, most of what we as political journalists talk about, people have very little interest in. So nobody's really talking about Tim Farron's views on gay sex or why Boris Johnson called Jeremy Corbyn a mugwump or any of that stuff. What there isn't really is any great sense of buy-in to the election. You meet the odd person who says, well, I understand Theresa May wants a bigger mandate and all the rest of it. But no one's terribly excited or interested. And equally, you don't meet many people who are content. There are all sorts of resentments and frustrations knocking around, but they don't map onto party divides. So you meet a lot of progressive people who feel the country's in a bad place because of Brexit, but they're not really convinced by Jeremy Corbyn. And one often gets the sense that the Lib Dems aren't really in their field of vision. And then you meet a lot of people who I've met in the last 2 days, a lot of people who voted for Brexit, who can't really tell you why and don't really have any sense of where that's up to, apart from the idea that they think we should have somehow left already. And it's not as if I think that they think Theresa May is their champion particularly. So it's very, very weird. I mean, 2015, I had this big sense of disconnect between people and politics. But I would say in the intervening 2 years, notwithstanding the referendum, it's got even bigger.
And so this idea that Labour has, that it's terribly, that Brexit is going to play very, very strongly. And then, you know, they've sort of agonised about, you know, we have to say that we're backing the result, but we don't like the way in which it's been done. And, it's a sort of very nuanced position they've got on Brexit. Are people not really seeing this as a rerun of the Brexit?
No, nobody's got any awareness of the Labour Party's nuanced and extremely complicated policy stances. What some people either think for themselves or have picked up from elsewhere is that Jeremy Corbyn is not a terribly convincing leader. So here's I'll spoil our film. A spoiler alert. We met a man who looked like he was in his 40s in a food bank in Camborne, which is expanding fast, and there's rising local need. And he was working zero-hour contracts. So he was in work, and yet he was in a food bank. And his whole predicament echoed a great deal of what Jeremy Corbyn says is wrong with Britain. This man had voted Labour all his life. He said Corbyn wasn't convincing and he wasn't going to vote for him this time. That, I would say, points up a hell of a problem. You've got people who really are experiencing in-work poverty and inequality at the sharp end who aren't necessarily convinced. And then you've got more sort of affluent progressives in a place like Bristol, where we were yesterday, who think the Labour Party has somehow taken a wrong turn on Brexit and are kind of looking for an alternative political home. Now, that may or may not be the Lib Dems, but, you know, reflecting their poll rating, it's not as if everyone's running around talking about what a great guy Tim Farron is. They're really not. The Lib Dems, as I say, in most cases, seem to be barely on people's horizon.
James, I'm sure you're running around talking about what a great guy Tim Farron is, but with your Lib Dem credentials. But you're working on a cross-party effort, aren't you? You are hoping that people are thinking quite a bit about Brexit.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth in what John says, in that the referendum sort of threw up the political cards into the air last year, and they've sort of scattered all over the place. And we've got a database at Open Britain of over half a million supporters, and we had thousands of them email in basically saying that they want to get involved in this election with candidates that, you know, oppose hard Brexit, and that traditional party lines are being pretty blurred. You know, we've had Conservative supporters email in, Labour supporters, Lib Dem supporters, Green supporters, all say the same thing, because the spectre of the referendum still hangs over people, and they're worried about the path that the government have taken, and they're even more worried about the path that they might take if they're returned with a whopping majority this time round.
Mm, but you've had a few difficulties, haven't you, that underline how difficult it is to work cross-party in Britain's electoral system. You lost a few high-profile Tory supporters this week, Tory MPs, didn't you, because they were uncomfortable with the idea of campaigning against other Tory MPs who back a hard Brexit.
Yeah, and I totally understand where they come from. Look, cross-party stuff is difficult in the heat and fury of a general election campaign. Partisanship and differences between parties do tend to become magnified. And I can only say it's been a pleasure to work with these Conservative MPs over the last
few months. Sort of Anna Soubrys and Nicky Morgans.
Morgan, Dominic Grieve, Neil Carmichael. They've been fantastic champions of an opposition to hard Brexit. But I totally respect the fact that they can't be involved with a campaign that is opposed to other Conservatives who do support a hard Brexit. Open Britain will always try and be cross-party, and the door will always be open when the heat and fury of a general election campaigns die down to do so in the future. But at the same time, if we're not going to campaign against particular candidates or for particular candidates who either oppose or support a hard Brexit in this election, we'd have to sit on the sidelines. And when the Prime Minister herself, when she announced this on the steps of Downing Street, said this was an election about Brexit, as a single issue political campaign against a hard Brexit and for a continued close relationship with Europe, I don't think we could have credibly said to our supporters, we want you to sit this one out, guys. You know, that's not what you're in politics for. It's certainly not what I'm in politics for. And I know it's not a lot of what our volunteers are in politics for.
Mm. John James was talking there a bit about sort of working with MPs with sort of shared views in different parties. Does it feel when you're out and about as if, you know, you look at France and look at Macron kind of emerging as this sort of centrist independent? Do you feel like what people need is a new political, some kind of new party grouping? There's a lot of chat about this, about, you know, a kind of new centrist group with, you know, Theresa May going off in a rightwards direction.
It's not like you stand outside Waitrose in Bristol and people say, do you know, I think we need a Macron-esque new centrist party along the lines of what Tony Blair seems to be proposing at the moment.
Yeah.
Of course, no.
Yeah.
But having said that,
is there a gap in the market though?
In particular. Yeah, but only in cities. Let's be very clear here. Contrary to Theresa May saying, oh, the country is coming together, it's not, right? We are hugely divided in all sorts of ways. And one of the big divisions was brought home to me in the journey from Cornwall through Yeovil, where the Lib Dems fancy their chances of taking the seats from the Tories, but they're not going on about Brexit because nobody in Yeovil really wants to talk about Brexit. They're banging on about how they're going to have a good local candidate, unlike the Tory MP who's not very good at casework, right? Then you get to Bristol, and you do meet people who feel strongly about Brexit, are worried about it and what it will do to the city of Bristol, right? Who perhaps have friends from Europe who are worried about their own situation here and so on. And they really do feel that their instincts are progressive and they haven't really got anywhere to confidently put their cross come election day. That's definitely an opening. Whether it's an opening for a national kind of serious political force, I don't know. But I would say that in London, Bristol, Manchester, those three stick out. There might be the first stirrings of an appetite for what you're talking about.
But Rowena, the real struggle for Labour here is that the more it tries to scoop up those people, those kind of progressives or, dare I call it, liberal metropolitans or whatever, you know, however you put it, who are concerned about Brexit and so on, that the more they risk alienating long-standing voters in heartland areas. That's one of the big questions, isn't it, about this election?
Yes, and it is a very big worry for the Labour Party that there might be a fracturing of its traditional coalition between the kind of metropolitan liberals that you describe and people in Labour heartlands in the north who were very, very much in favour of Brexit. And some people have described it as the 0% strategy because there is this risk that the metropolitan liberals might feel like the party is just too Brexity and people who were in very much in favour of Brexit might just think, well, we might as well go for the Conservatives because they're the ones that are actually carrying it out at the moment. So there's this very sort of nuanced, carefully thought out line that Keir Starmer, the shadow Brexit secretary, has stitched together and thinks it could square off some of these difficulties and keep everybody together. But the risk is that it ends up pleasing nobody very much at all.
Yeah. And James, how much upside, you're not here with your Lib Dem hat on, obviously, but how much upside do you think there is for the Lib Dems? Tim Farron's certainly on fighting form.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Lib Dems, when you speak to them, are extremely chipper and they've got every right to be. They've got a very clear position on Europe, which completely outflanks the Labour Party. They're taking that message out to people in the country and they fancy their chances in some of the places that John was talking about, in Bristol, in Bath, in some of those seats in southwest London. I think anywhere where there's a Conservative incumbent in an area that was a leaver or hasn't really spoken out much since the referendum, where there's a strong Lib Dem challenge, I know the Lib Dems are feeling pretty confident.
There aren't a huge number of those seats, though, are there? I mean, there's a sort of sprinkling of them in the southwest London, but in the southwest, most of those seats that are former Lib Dem seats are very strongly Leave. So,
yeah, there's not a huge number, but you've got to remember the Lib Dems are starting from 9, so you know it's starting from a low base.
But it doesn't feel like they're going to sort of soar back up to the mid 50s in terms of seats, which is what we saw in you know that was the level that they had during the coalition years.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the ambition they'll be setting themselves. You know, it's only 2 years ago, remember, that people were writing the obituaries of the Liberal Democrats, saying that they were finished as a political force, that liberalism in this country was over. And yet, it shows how fluid, I think, British politics is at the moment, that now people are saying, oh, well, it's not that good. They're not going to win 50-odd seats. So, you know, I think they'll fight a good campaign. The Lib Dems are good campaigners. You can level a lot of things at the Lib Dems, but they're good at knocking on doors and getting out on the doorstep and delivering leaflets, and they'll do that with a very, very clear message on probably the clearest message of any party on Brexit, and they'll take that message out to people, and we'll see where we are in 6 weeks.
John, it sounds as though you're not in quite the right part of the country to ask you this question yet, but I know you're around and about all the time. What about UKIP? Have they got anything to say to any of these people?
You said earlier that Brexit seemed to have done for UKIP. I think as much as that's true, UKIP have done for UKIP. I mean, the central fact about UKIP, and maybe there's a bit of hindsight here, is it kind of to some degree was a personality cult. And without Nigel Farage, it seems to lose a great deal of its luster. That's one point. I think the second point is just hopelessly organised political force, you know. If you ever watched a team of UKIP people canvassing, for example, there's no real sense they know what they're doing or there are any kind of watertight systems in place. It's a shambles, you know. Whereas when I went out with the Lib Dems in Yeovil, they all had iPads with this American software which has the most forensic kind of canvassing system on it. You know, it's not biros and wet pieces of paper anymore. They knew exactly what they were doing. And actually, in Yeovil, they knew not to bang on about Brexit. See, the Lib Dems know that if you're going to begin to turn the political tide very often, don't go on about big stuff. They were knocking on people's doors, admittedly, partly because the local elections were approaching. And they were talking about the state of the local roads and playing fields and all of that stuff, and thinking that was the way to beat the Tories. And again, UKIP are pretty hopeless at all that. You know, hello, vote for me, I'm going to ban the burqa. And someone says, well, what are you going to do about the fact there's no car park?
Rowena, we've had some really interesting polls already, haven't we? Including one in Wales, for example, that showed Labour suffering a kind of Scotland-style collapse. But certainly, Labour strategists, obviously, they have their own reasons to do so, but are really kind of playing down the accuracy of the polls and saying, you know, they're not much good and we'll close this lead and we don't believe it. How do we treat the polls, do you think, during this campaign?
Well, we have to remember that the polls come with a massive health warning. They didn't get things right in 2015. They didn't get things right at the referendum. That said, the lead that the polls are showing for the Conservatives does suggest that they are probably ahead. And one of the best measures, I think, is talking to Labour MPs who are just so depressed in a lot of areas, having been out on the doorstep for the local elections over the past few weeks. There are ones with majorities of up to 10,000 who are fretting about the possibility of losing their seats or having the majorities massively reduced. And part of the worry is in areas where there's a big UKIP vote, that all those UKIP voters will go over to the Tories and that some of their own side might stay home.
Yeah, I spoke to one yesterday in just such an area who was, I said, how's it going? And they said, I'm thinking about my unexpected career change. But we'll have to leave that there for now. But there's plenty more election news, polls and analysis on theguardian.com/politics. Now, in an election cycle dominated by Brexit, it may seem odd that the only party not really focused on the EU is UKIP. Instead, the party's used its first media outings to bang on about banning the burqa as part of a raft of policies that would make life harder for Muslims. So what's going on? I called up Matthew Goodwin, a political scientist and author of the definitive early history of UKIP, Revolt on the Right. Matthew, what state is UKIP in as it comes to contest this election?
There's no doubt that since the 2016 referendum, UKIP has experienced a lot of problems. It's obviously lost Nigel Farage, who, you know, was a charismatic talisman and was replaced by Paul Nuttall, who hasn't really connected to the same extent. It's also gone through some difficult parliamentary by-election campaigns, not really seeing much growth in areas like Copeland or Stoke, in fact, going backwards, you might argue. And in local elections, local by-elections, we've seen UKIP really struggle, as we have in the national opinion polls. So if you were to just take the average of the UKIP vote in the polls since the general election was called, UKIP has averaged 7.2%, which is obviously a way down on the nearly 13% that the party polled at the 2015 general election and the 18% or so that it was polling ahead of the referendum. So that broader problem has coincided with the party's competition with Theresa May's Conservative Party, which has really, you know, parked its tanks on the UKIP lawn, with Theresa May's advisers being very clear in setting out their determination to win back those traditional social conservatives who had defected to UKIP through things like expressing support for grammar schools, you know, using the Brexit means Brexit narrative, being seen to prioritise immigration controls over single market access. And all of those things have clearly had an effect, with a large number of UKIP voters going back to the Conservatives.
And is it? It's a valid fear, is it, that so certainly Labour MPs in kind of what you would think of as traditional heartland seats, where UKIP did quite well in 2015, are very, very worried about UKIP Tory switches. That's a valid concern, you think?
I think we're now witnessing a very interesting dynamic in British politics, in that over the last 3 years, we've seen the Labour Party panic about the rise of UKIP. And I think we are now going to see the Labour Party panic about the collapse of UKIP, because the collapse of UKIP really has big implications for Labour. If, for example, you look at data in the British Election Study, which was collected in December of 2016, so before we've seen a more rapid decline in UKIP's polling, even then you can see that of those voters who are defecting away from UKIP, the majority of them are going back to the Conservative Party. And that is true both in Labour Conservative marginal seats and also Conservative Liberal Democrat marginal seats. So what does that mean? It means that those figures are Conservative. So if we assume that the Conservatives are winning back around half of the UKIP vote, then there are around 30 to 45 Labour-held seats that would instantly go Conservative, because Labour MPs in those areas have low majorities now, and because of the swing in the polling that we're seeing nationally, part of which is because of the UKIP to Conservative switching, but not all of it is because of that. So this is really going to have massive implications for the Labour Party in seats. You know, that you could start in a seat like Chester, where you've got a Labour majority of a few hundred.
Tiny majority, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but you can also basically go up to Labour constituencies where the Labour MP has a majority of, you know, 8,000-9,000 votes, where they will be under threat from a Conservative combined with UKIP vote.
And presumably the result in the Copeland by-election, which the Tories took, will have given them confidence that they can attack right into these kinds of areas.
I think the Conservatives are certainly confident that they can win over these UKIP voters, and also they are quite confident that they can win over the softer end of the Remain vote, right? Because what we're not seeing in the data is a real realignment election. What we're seeing is a sort of part realignment election, and what I mean by that is you're seeing UKIP voters go back to the Conservatives because basically they got what they wanted. They got the referendum, and they got the vote for Brexit, and they're getting promises of free movement reform. But what we are not seeing on the other side of that coin is a realignment, a strong realignment around either Labour or the Liberal Democrats among Remainers. Indeed, in Conservative Liberal Democrat marginals, where some people are saying the Liberal Democrats will give the Conservatives a bloody nose, we're actually seeing UKIP voters in those seats go to the Conservatives. We're also seeing some Liberal Democrats go to Labour, which will also hit the Liberal Democrats. So all of this is pointing to an increased Conservative majority and no real obvious stable home for all of those Remain voters who don't appear currently to be mobilising in a very big way that you might expect if this were truly just a Brexit election. Mm.
It's interesting. I'm certainly hearing from MPs that Brexit is not coming up as much on the doorstep as they might have expected to, given how kind of agonised, you know, the Article 50 legislation was in Parliament and so on. I don't think it's necessarily top of people's list. So this is a terrible moment for UKIP, isn't it? Because Theresa May is saying, right, I'm cracking on with Brexit, I'm doing it, you know, I'm going to limit immigration, I'm doing everything you want me to do. Could there be a moment for them in the future if, for example, the deal that she comes back with is something they don't consider to be Brexit on their terms? Or, you know, is there a kind of protest vote that they might be able to harness at some time in the future? Or do you think the party's on its way out?
Well, I think it's certainly a terrible moment for UKIP, but you might also argue it's a triumph for the ideas that they'd put on the table. I mean, it's quite interesting to look at, you know, the debate that we've had about populism in Europe, and one of the most influential populist parties in Europe has been UKIP, despite having almost no representation in the national legislature. And I think there's a really interesting message about how we understand populism in Europe. They don't always need to win seats in order to have an influence. But going forward, I think one of the interesting things, as you say, is, look, is there actually potential for some kind of populist movement in Britain beyond the UK Independence Party? I think when you look at France, so this is a really interesting comparison at the moment, because if you look at France, Marine Le Pen is offering similar groups of voters. They tend to be younger, but they're also blue collar, low incomes, feeling left behind economically, anxious over immigration. She's offering those voters two things. One is cultural protectionism. Let's reduce immigration. Let's push back against Islam, all that kind of stuff. but she's also offering them economic protectionism. You know, let's push back against globalization, let's ensure companies hire native workers, all that sort of stuff. What UKIP never really offered in Britain was the economic protectionism, largely because it's led by economic liberals, but it did offer them the cultural side. I would suggest that in Britain, what you can see clearly, both through the collapse of Labour and the concerns that Labour voters have, and the collapse of UKIP and the concerns that some traditional social conservatives have, is a potential for a movement that talks about both economic protectionism, look at the bankers, look at the city, look at the lack of regulation, look at how Britain's turning into a low-tax, post-Brexit bargain economy, bargain basement economy. But on the other hand, also appealing to voters who feel that May is not going even hard enough on issues like free movement and immigration, because over the medium to long term, it is distinctly unlikely that we will ever return to those tens of thousands of levels of net migration that Theresa May is sort of still clinging to. So I think there will be potential, but I don't necessarily think that will come through the UK Independence Party. But just a quick final point, at this general election, I think what might be interesting, given what Paul Nuttall and some of his advisors have been saying over the last couple of weeks, I do wonder whether in some more northern Labour seats, where perhaps the Conservatives are still seen as being very toxic, that classic statement, I would never vote for the Tories, I just wonder in some of those seats where UKIP is completely decimated in southern Conservative England, might we see voters say, look, I don't want to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, I don't want to go into apathy, but the only other party that's available that you know isn't Theresa May and the Tories is UKIP. So will we see the UKIP vote hold up in some of those northeast, northwest seats more than we will see it hold up in southern non-London England?
Yeah, and part of the question for them at the moment, given limited resources, is where they target their, you know, resources, isn't it? Which seats they fight? That's quite an interesting question, because those areas that you're talking about are not necessarily those that they might see as their happiest hunting grounds. It's quite interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, a senior sort of UKIP source said to me the other day that their goal is, in their words, to stay on the pitch, because they are, you know, fearful that they will be completely wiped off the map of British politics. But they also believe firmly that Theresa May will backslide on Brexit. So they want to be around to pick up on public disillusionment when it is revealed, for example, that, you know, perhaps there's a transition deal that lasts for 5 years, but which continues with free movement as it currently stands, something that would really alienate traditional social conservatives who feel that at the moment they're voting for May because she's promising those issues. Now, for Labour, that really matters, because as one Labour MP said to me not long ago, you know, the problem for Labour is that there are elements of hard Brexit that really appeal in Labour heartlands. And one of those elements is the current issue of restricting free movement. Another is, you know, Britain not paying into the EU budget and removing the jurisdiction of European courts. So that hard Brexit narrative is also kind of cutting across the Labour areas, as it might potentially also do in Conservative areas, if indeed it's not delivered.
Yeah, and I was going to say to you, when you were talking about that sort of populist, you know, Le Penist type policies earlier, I was, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party absolutely has one half of that script, doesn't it? The, you know, look at the cosy cartels running politics, look at the city, look at the bankers, you know, look at low wages, but it absolutely doesn't do the other part of that script, which is you know, sort of anti, you know, immigration.
But this is where you can begin to see how Labour can quite quickly get back on its feet. If Labour were talking in a similar way, but with a credible messenger on things like inequality, on fairness, on bank regulation, on tax avoidance, on people not having a pay rise for more than 10 years, the squeeze middle, the just about managing, on that side of the narrative, you know, Labour really has a lot of space. The problem, as I would suggest, was reflected again this week, is that Labour does not have a coherent message on the social and cultural side of the debate, on issues like free movement and immigration. So were I a Labour MP, I would be tempted to say, look, the position that the Labour Party needs to get into is to say, right, we accept that free movement cannot continue in its current form, and that is important to large chunks of Labour-held territory. But that doesn't mean that Labour cannot then set out a progressive immigration policy that is around things like standing up for international students, ensuring that we have good, high-skilled forms of migration that contribute to things like the welfare state and which benefit the national community, and that Labour begins to get into a narrative which is more in tune with where the average voter is on these issues. That is how, in my view, Labour gets back on its feet, not through this convoluted, quite muddled messaging on the cultural identity issues while trying to make a convincing case on economics, but with a very bad messenger. And that's where Labour's facing real problems.
Interesting. Matthew Goodwin, thank you very much. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Rowena Mason, John Harris, James McGrory and Matthew Goodwin. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.